Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives, sharing their expertise and life stories, making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. In her own words, Liza Rodman was a lonely little girl. During Cape Cod summers, her mother worked days in a motel and danced most nights in the Provincetown bars, leaving her alone with local handyman Tony Costa. He was one of the few understanding adults in Liza's life, but years later, she was haunted by nightmares, and that's when she learned her charismatic babysitter was also a vicious serial killer. Could you imagine? Well, part memoir, part true crime, Liza Rodman and Jennifer Jordan are friends of 40 plus years. They joined forces to tell this chilling real life story in The Babysitter, My Summers with a Serial Killer. We're going to explore a lot of that today. Lots to talk about, so let me tell you a little about each of my guests. Liza Rodman has a BA focused in creative writing, and this is her first book. Jennifer Jordan is an award-winning author, filmmaker, and screenwriter with decades of experience as a news anchor and investigative journalist. The Babysitter is her fifth book. All right, let me bring on my guests today, Liza Rodman and Jennifer Jordan. And their book is The Babysitter, My Summers with a Serial Killer. There's so much to talk about in this book, so many angles to come from. I wanted to begin with how you guys met, though, because you have a lifelong friendship, almost lifelong friendship. And I hear, Jennifer, that came about because you're somewhat of a coffee snob. So tell us how you guys met, if you would.
I am indeed a coffee snob. And when I set out to college, I did so with my plug-in Farberware percolator. And so one morning I was brewing my coffee, and in the door came a coffee mug first, and then Liza asking for a cup of decent coffee after what had been probably a month of, you know, choking down the swill in the university cafeteria. And that really started it. And from there, we would hitchhike home to each other's family, mine in Vermont, hers in Boston. We even spent a summer chambermaiding together out in Oregon, on the Oregon coast. And we have followed each other and each other's lives through these years.
That's pretty.
So here we are 40-something years later.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome, pretty special. Well, the book itself, it moves between part memoir, part true crime story. It's intertwined throughout the book. And I want to begin with your story, Liza. You tell the story of you growing up in the 60s with your siblings and a single mother who was, let's say, less than present. She was seemed a heavy drinker. She was abusive, often missing in action, and frequently known to stop random strangers in the supermarket to ask if they babysat. So it seems not a lot of nurturing or guidance going on for you and your siblings. And then Tony Costa comes into your life. So tell us how that happened.
So I'd want to contextualize my mother just for a minute, because she does come off like that. But she was divorced, and it was very unpopular to be so and be a Catholic. And so she was sort of thrust into that world, and she was pissed. She was angry.
Right.
So that's the beginning of the story. Then her very best friend, and her very, very best friend's husband built this beautiful, big, huge resort on the bay in Provincetown, Massachusetts, called the Royal Coachman. And that was 1966. And my mother was a school teacher. She taught high school home economics. And so she had her summers free. And she was always looking. She was a go-getter, my mother, and always looking to make extra money and do what she had to do. So when her best friend called her and said, hey, want to come to Provincetown for the summer and work as a chambermaid and we'll have some fun, it didn't take long for my mother to say yes. So that is how we ended up meeting. First, I met Tony's mother, who was also hired as a chambermaid at the Royal Coachman. And through Tony's mother, Tony
was able to get a job as the hotel handyman. And that's how it all came down.
Right, right. And he was there for around 3 years, as I understand from reading the book. You were connected with him for about 3 years. You saw him as your babysitter. Your mum kind of denied that later on, said, you know, he was just the handyman. And then he suddenly disappears when you're, what, 10?
10, right. It was the summer of 68, or the fall of 68 was the last time I saw him. And then he was arrested for his first two murders in January of 69. And remember, we were only there in the summer. So that which went down in the winter wasn't sometimes known to us even.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right, and you had no idea of that at the time anyway.
None. Neither did they. Neither did they. They didn't know until after he was arrested.
Right. And so then many years later, we're talking, what, like 35 years later?
In my 40s, yeah.
Yeah, you start having these nightmares about this guy, but he's hunting you. You can't see a face until a couple of years into these nightmares, and then you suddenly see Tony's face. What was that like? What was going through your head when that happened?
Well, I think, first of all, it was terrifying. I had these recurrent nightmares, and for a while I thought, maybe I have a brain tumor, or I'm going crazy, or whatever. And the more they went on, the longer they went on, the more I started writing them down, trying to figure out what was happening. Mm-hmm. So when I finally saw a face, and I woke up in the middle, at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was just, I was absolutely gobsmacked. And that's why I decided to start asking questions, because suddenly this anonymous man became Tony Costa.
Right.
And
right.
I hadn't thought about Tony for many years, so.
Right. And it was your mom who said, well, he turned out to be a serial killer.
Right. Right. Yeah, some women's sons become doctors, and I guess others become serial killers.
Right. So, Jennifer, you've been lifelong friends. What point did you learn about Liza's nightmares, and how did that lead to you writing a book together?
I learned one visit to Boston. I had since moved to Utah, and I was visiting Boston and staying with Liza and her husband. And she was telling me that she had started having these nightmares. And lo and behold, in one of those nightmares, she saw the face of a babysitter that she'd had on Cape Cod years before, had never thought of him since. And he turned out to be a serial killer. And I, at that point, said, okay, stop the presses. You've been wanting to write. This is the book you need to write. Going to be called The Babysitter, and it's going to be a bestseller. In subsequent visits and phone calls with Liza, I would say, how's The Babysitter coming? How are you doing on it? And she finally got to the point of putting her fingers in her ears and la, 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 I don't want to talk about it somewhere. I can't deal with it. It's too much of a story. And so I got to the point in my writing where I was between books, and I said, listen, I know it's a difficult structure. I know it's a tough narrative because it's got to be both memoir and true crime. You can't just have it from the young girl's voice. You've got to have both. Let me help you do this. And that was the beginning. And that was probably in 2017 or 18. And we dove right in. And I called my agent. My agent said, oh, my God, get me something fast. And here we are, three years later.
Right. And so, Liza, I mean, this idea percolated for a long time for you. And you've got Jennifer jabbing at you all the time. When you finally made that commitment to write this with her, that's a big step for you. How did you feel about it?
It was a very big step. I cried. It's a good story, because when Jen said, listen, why don't we collaborate, I cried. And because I had been researching now since 2005, not really, and writing, drafts and writing my stories down. And I had been done a lot of research and writing in between those years, none of which was cohesive at all. And so I cried when she said it. And then I sent her 1,100 pages of research. Said, okay, this is where we start. But I also knew that this was the story kind of my lifetime, and because it wouldn't let me go. it would not let me go, no matter how many times I put it down. It kept coming back up. There was Jen saying, how's the babysitter coming? I mean, there were so many opportunities to walk away from this story, and I couldn't.
Right, right.
Well, so in a way, I was, you know, it was that double-edged sword. I was afraid. I was all, my emotions were all over the place.
Right.
Through the whole process, really.
I can imagine. I mean, I really think you had to rip yourself open to write your part of this. And of course, it draws on Jennifer's background as a journalist. So, I mean, it's the perfect marriage here by the sound of it.
I had come to feel that this book could only have been written by two authors. But that's after the fact.
And so, Jennifer, Liza just mentioned she sent you 1,100 pages of research. You also found 100 hours of interview tapes from Tony Costa. You had a lot of material to work from, unpublished manuscripts detailing his life and crimes. He'd been married, he was a dad, a drug user. He's described as gentle, intelligent, a coward who blamed his alter egos for the murders, and they were pretty brutal. And he obviously had a disdain for women. Saw himself as a victim even after committing those brutal murders. How would you describe him? What when you've gone through all of this and put it all together, how would you describe him?
Well, that's one question you got there, Vicky. how would I describe him? I would describe him as a monster. In simply put, he was a megalomaniac. He was a pathological, malignant narcissist. And he was also a very, very damaged psychopath. And so when I dove into those 1,100 pages that Liza had gathered and written over the years, it was overwhelming. And it was really, and as Liza said, this book needed two authors for many reasons, one of them being that Liza, even with all of this research and all this knowledge of the monster he became, she still, to this day, has a soft heart and a gentle place for him in her memory. So it needed somebody to come in and say, whoa, your memory may have been soft and sweet, but guess what? You know, you escaped with your life from a horrific, as I, you know, the best word is monster. And so it needed me or whatever writer to come in and really be the sounding board of that fact for in the process, so that the memoir wasn't only about Tony buying the popsicles it was also about after he bought you your favorite popsicle, he went out to his secret garden where his bodies were buried.
Right.
So it needed both of those voices, and as I said, I came into this research cold and was able to offer that objective voice.
Right, right. And it's very seamless that throughout the book, two voices, but it's one voice throughout the book. Job well done on that. You know, one thing when somebody is connected or knows somebody or even loves somebody who's being accused of being a murderer, there's always this difficulty to reconcile the man they know with this man who committed this heinous crime. So did you ever get any resolution around that, Liza?
Yeah, well, the resolution I have is that it's likely not going to change, that the duality of the chapters, the duality of the story, the duality between my mother and Tony, all of that, and the duality of Tony's personality and how I knew him versus how I know him as an adult, me being the adult, I think it's not going to change. And so I'm always going to walk that thin line between what I remember. And his mother was equally as wonderful, maybe more so. And so I had two of them over there who I remember fondly in the midst of absolute chaos in my personal life. And I've said this many times, but I'm going to say it again. You don't forget that kindness when you don't have it at home. So I will never forget the kindness, But I also have deep, what's the word, for what he did. You know, I mean, he really, those are heinous crimes he committed. And there are places in our society now where we can start to predict this behavior, and I think we need to stop this from ever happening again to any family.
Right.
You know, both, you know, I mean, his family still deals with it.
Right.
The family is the victims still deal with it.
Right.
So...
Well, the concept of a serial killer is relatively new. It wasn't until like the late 60s, early 70s when that serial killer was identified. So, Jennifer, I'm wondering how he finally got caught and how long this took. Why he got away with it for so long? That he committed 5 known murders and suspected of several more.
Right. And the reason that he finally got caught is because of his own greed and his own arrogance in taking his last 2 victims' car. And when it was finally discovered that he was driving those victims' car, that victim's car, the pieces started to fall into place. And one of the reasons that Tony was able to get away with it for as long as he did is because he was in the middle of what Norman Mailer called the Wild West of the East. Provincetown at that time was an enclave for the outcasts of the world and the artists and drugs and sex and rock and roll. I mean, it all became a gathering place of just this outlaw province, if you will. And so Tony blended in perfectly with that kind of, well, you know, hippies, and we don't know why she disappeared. We know she was laughing with Tony Costa, but, you know, he said she went to Mexico, so who's to say? And that went on for months of him just kind of brushing off people's questioning of what happened to this one, and then this one, and then this one. And his behavior was also spiraling down. So something, I think, physically was happening at the same time that his greed got the better of him. You know, I think he was coming apart.
Hmm. Now, didn't he, it's intimated that he knew he had a problem because he'd read a lot of psych books, including the DSM, and so he knew something was wrong with him, right?
Mm-hmm, he did. I think he did. I mean, given what he was reading, the tenets of psychoneurosis, I think he was looking to see if he could figure out, because he fancied himself something. I mean, he thought he was super intelligent and could probably figure out what was wrong with him.
Yeah.
He wasn't a clear thinker, you know?
Yeah.
Crazy.
So let's talk about these alter egos that he developed. And he basically said that they were all the victims, even right after he'd murdered, I don't recall the name, but right after he'd murdered, I think it was Marianne, Patricia, he'd murdered them, and he prayed to God and then sat there and said, we are the victims.
Right, and that's the megalomania. That's the victim in that narcissist thinking. It's always about myself, and it's all, if I'm hurting, somebody else is at fault.
Yeah.
Right, I'm a victim of drugs.
Right.
I'm a victim of drugs, of circumstance. We, Liza and I, truly believe in trying as best we could piece together the actual murders, that he was probably shamed or laughed at by Marianne and possibly Pat, and that pulled a trigger for him where, again, he became the victim.
Right.
Well, how am I to be blamed? She laughed at me. How, you know, it's not my fault. Why did she, you know, dot, dot, dot? So it's always somebody else's fault, even his victim.
Right. There's a very telling line in the book, Jennifer, where he says at his funeral, you write, at his funeral, he finally got his mom all to himself.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh, and that when Liza speaks of her affection for Cecilia, Tony's mother, part of me always, clenches up because, again, coming in as an objective observer of this history, not having witnessed Tony or Cecilia for myself,
I get a chill up my spine when I think of Cecilia, because not only was she most likely, we'll never know, but most likely a perpetrator of abuse on Tony that really pushed all of his physical and genetic predispositions to psychopathy over the edge. But she most likely, given, and this is coming from Tony's own words, witnessed one of his brutal killings. And yet never turned him in. It was always my Tony this and my Tony that, and my Tony can do no wrong. So for me, coming to it cold, yes, Tony finally got Cecilia all to himself.
Right, right. Liza, I want to look at your demons, if you will, and I hate to use that term, but for want of a better term, okay. You write in the book, I always felt something was wrong with me, inherently deep and dirty and dark, something unlikable and fixable and lovable that carried through to your adult life. On your therapist's advice, you met with your mom to get some answers, since that's where most of the angst stemmed from. And she told you, I don't know about you, but the day you were born, I always felt you were out to get me. She didn't want a child at that point. You were a girl. She wanted a boy. And you were just like your dad. So hearing her say that as an adult and knowing what you'd gone through as a kid, tell us how you felt in that moment.
In that moment, actually, I felt like she set me free, because there was an absolute understanding that there was nothing I could have done, and therefore there was nothing I did. Although it took me many, 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 many years to actually reconcile that, what went down between my mother and I, and really till the day she died. I don't think I got set free till the day she died. And we always had that relationship, and it was very difficult. And anybody who would think that of an infant has to really be on the sociopathy scale themselves. My mother had a real lack of empathy, which I thought was interesting given my proximity to Tony. So, you know, and I was more afraid of her than I ever was of him.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's been a tough life in that way, but we all have something.
Right.
And those demons brought me here to this place, to this conversation. So in a way, I have to be grateful for it all, the good and the bad.
And tell me from an emotional point of view why you wanted to tell your story. It's a very personal story. So why did you want to get this out in print?
A very specific reason, because I think that, I was haunted by it. And so when you're haunted by something like that, you follow through whether you want to or not. But for two, there are other people out there like me, and they are feeling those same things, the imposter syndrome of writing and that something's inherently wrong with them. And so this is a story where both Jen and I strived to get the vulnerability on the page so that other people could see themselves and say, and they, you know, I can't tell you the number of times I've gotten an email or a comment saying, I had a mother like that. And I don't know. For me, when I read other people's stories, I feel less alone. And so that was part of this process, too, is to find the universal in my experience, and hope that the reader could do the same.
Right, right. Jennifer, I wanted to talk about one of the women that came in and out of Tony's life, and that was Christine. It was really interesting to read that he said about Christine, she was everything I was looking for in a woman. She was me. She was myself. That sounds incredibly narcissistic. Tell us about that relationship and how that fit into things.
Well, again, Tony's version versus reality. Tony's version was that they were in love. He was telling people they were going to get married. And the real version is she was telling people that he frightened her, that he was quote, too much, and that she was planning on marrying her longtime boyfriend. And that's probably what pushed him over the edge. Well, if I can't have you, guess what? He's not going to have you either.
No one will.
And so, the Christine, like, his other victims as well, well, at least two of his other victims, were really, really sad and lonely cases. They abused drugs. Their family life was horrific. And they thought Tony might be a salvation for them. And by the time they realized he wasn't, it was too late. And Christine was just about to set herself free from Tony. But as I said, he said, no, you're not setting me free.
So what were the difficulties? I'm going to ask both of you this same question. What were the challenges of writing this story from each of your perspectives? So, Jennifer, why don't we begin with you?
My challenge in writing it was really to honor Liza's story while being the omniscient narrator, the journalist, trying to tell the true crime version, not version, but true crime part of it, while also realizing that Liza had a very, as she said, a very personal involvement, the most personal involvement you can have with a story. I mean, your mother and your childhood. And so as I set about kind of figuring out the back and forth of the Liza Tony chapters, my struggle as a journalist was one of wanting just, kind of the Hemingway facts on the page, and let's get this out. And yes, we can use the word abuse in relationship to your mother. And so it's those kinds of struggles for me, and then therefore for Liza, to really allow the story to be there in its complexity and in its entirety, because it had to go back and forth, as we've discussed. But doing so, dipping into Liza's story and then back to the really cold, ugly reality of Tony's story, was a delicate balance.
Right, I can imagine. And so, Liza, from your perspective, I mean, going beyond the obvious angst that you went through while you're opening up all these wounds again, what was the challenge in actually writing Liza's story?
I'd been writing it for so many years that I think that part of it was less challenging. Those stories were already down on paper. It was just a matter of how we were going to fit them into the manuscript. I think the culling away and the learning process was, the learning curve was steep for me. And I worried about sabotaging the whole process because it was so personal and because it was so painful. So I worked with a therapist on not doing that. I don't think there was anything that wasn't challenging about it, except the stories. The stories were sort of set in stone long before the writing ever came down.
Right. And so I'm going to ask this again to each of you. What can you tell us about collaborating with a writing partner? Because many have tried and failed. So Liza, I'm sorry, I keep calling you Liza and I don't mean to. Liza.
Okay.
What can you tell us about collaborating with a writing partner?
Well, again, first time I've ever done it. Thank God it was a dear friend. Because we needed that trust between us. And I'm not saying we didn't have difficulties, because of course we did. You don't not have difficulties when you collaborate with someone on a creative project. But here we are, and we made it to the other side. So I would say that while these processes are, the creative process itself is inherently messy. And so just accepting that going into the collaboration, I think was a good thing, at least for me, to expect it to be messy.
Right. And Jennifer, from your perspective, what did you learn about collaborating with a writing partner? What tips would you give?
Before this project, I had ghostwritten two other memoirs with two other women who I had not known before. They hired me to write their stories. And so I knew a lot more about the collaborative process in writing just coming into this. So that was a wonderful preamble for me to understand the flow of the information and how to kind of coax some of the information that the subject herself might not want to give. But taking it one step further with Liza, I mean, I've known her 40 years. So I was able to, you know, to do some of that coaxing in a more learned and a more loving and a more understanding way than I had with the previous two. So all along the way, as Liza said, it certainly had its ups and downs, but it was also such a joy to spend quality time
with somebody I've known and loved so long.
Right.
And even though we've known each other, you know, longer than most people have been alive, it seems, the friendship is even more cemented for me. It's even richer and deeper. I mean, having gone to where we did to get this book to where it is, it's been a joy.
I love to hear that. One of the most fascinating tidbits, if you will, is that during the course of your research, and you did extensive research on this, as we've talked about, during the course of your research, you actually resolved 3 cold cases. Just quickly share a highlight on that, if you would, for us.
Yes. In reading previous chroniclers' accounts of these crimes and of Tony Costa, and if you were to go on Wikipedia today, it's still there. There's a sentence that says, and they were never seen alive again. And when it came our time to write that sentence, my, you know, 40 years in journalism stopped me cold at the keyboard and said, wait a minute, I can't write that. I don't know it to be true.
Cut and paste, right?
Right. So we went back and we engaged search engines that didn't even exist 50 years ago. And we're, after a year of cross-referencing names and possible children and possible relatives, we narrowed it down, and I started calling and writing. And lo and behold, I found 3 of those women that had, you know, air quotes, gone missing 50 years ago, last seen with Tony Costa. And lo and behold, no, they hadn't gone missing. They hadn't been last seen with Tony Costa. They had all met him and all spent time with him, but they had all since also died, but not at the hands of Tony Costa.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful thing to not so much rewrite their history, but to correct their history so that their sisters and daughters don't have to read a book and see that their mother was never seen alive again. Well, yes, here she is.
Yes, she was. Well, it's been such a pleasure talking with you both, Liza Rodman, Jennifer Jordan. Yeah, we could talk about this for hours, but I have to let you go. And the book is called The Babysitter, My Summers with a Serial Killer. And listeners can find out much more about you and your work. I've got lisarodman.com, where you can actually find out about the book there. And also a website for Jennifer at jenniferjordan.net. So I'd like to ask each of you, let's begin with Liza, a final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with today.
I would love if this book kind of spurred a conversation about mental health and about the ways in which we can prevent these things from happening again, both as children in my life and in Tony's life. You know, we've got ways as a society to start to deal with these things and to predict them. And so I would love if that could happen. Save some lives.
Excellent. And Jennifer?
I would say that it's important for all of us, and maybe particularly for women, to trust their voices and to trust their dreams. And Liza's dreams revealed a truth that it took her years to unearth. And I think that we often are dismissed, and that we dismiss some of those inner voices. And I would ask each of us to really, you know, trust that if we have some messages coming to us, to honor those messages and to perhaps do a little digging and to see what might be behind them.
Yes, and to listen to those whispers we get in everyday life. I think that's a great note to end our conversation on. Again, the book is called The Babysitter, My Summers with a Serial Killer. And my guests, Liza Rodman and Jennifer Jordan. Thanks both for being with us today.
Thanks, Vicki. It was a pleasure.
If you have questions, comments, or feedback regarding today's podcast, you can reach me on our website at conversationslive.net. Thanks for joining us today. We'll have a new podcast go live next Wednesday. Until then, live well, live strong.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.